In that sense, I have a question. You know, how would you say what is the most important, or let's say, what are the options? How to practice with getting older, getting more, getting weaker, physically, mentally, as resilient.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know how much what your experience is, but I'm curious to not just theoretically know what to do, but
I think, you know, so much of it is so actually putting into practice what we've been teaching all this. Because, you know, again, on the theory, we know it. It's okay, we have to, you know, accepting, letting go, knowing one's limitations, being kind to oneself. Those are all really important. And it sort of becomes even more important as you get older.
Yeah, because you can only accept.
Yes, in the end, all you can do is just accept it. And actually enjoy it.
Yeah. And then in terms of the practice, you know, to prepare for dying, having a good transition, I had the feeling I need to practice with non-self. But then I realized that this is just another idea.
Already is non-self.
Yeah.
I think the main thing is getting a comfortable chair.
Yeah, it appeared. Somebody suddenly donated.
There you go.
It's waiting for me at the moment. But I would love to come back to Chittas because supportive, you know?
The nature is exceptional. I mean, England in general is an extremely beautiful country, and the nature is, I mean, it's so lush here. So even in a place like Amaravati, which is, you know, close to London, out in the fields, it's still countryside. Is really lush, and the fact that they've got, you know, very limited space, but it's not that long ago. It's maybe, 40 years ago that they first moved there and then started planting trees around the border. That's all dense sort of forest. And even though it's not extensive forest like Chittas, if you're in a kuti, you're by yourself. So it's quite, and just the nature of, this is a very benign climate, you know, different than California, where, say, like summertime like this, July, 40, 43, 44. It's not weird. That's not strange. But then, of course, it does cool down at night, but still, it gets blistering hot. And that's different. You have to, it's just, it's extremes. Or like Tisarna, where it's 40 below.
I have a question.
Yes.
I was wondering about how to find a good balance between personal, individual practice and helping the community or assisting, supporting. Yeah. And I was wondering also how you have been practicing with that yourself, having had the role of adult for such a long time, finding that your individual practice.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is, I mean, you do need to have some personal time. We can get pretty obsessed sometimes, trying to have as much solitude as possible. And so much of it comes from, oftentimes it comes from a place of fear or aversion and just not wanting to deal with people. You know, and people are irritating. still the sense of, different, just being in different monasteries and being in different situations, the opportunity and being at different times, you know, the opportunity is different, and trying to, and seeing what works for our own personality. But, even for myself, having been put in a position from quite a young age, really, as abbot of Wat Nanachat and then being, taking on responsibilities and then starting a place in California, I've always, made sure that I've got time to have solitude on a daily basis and just being able to, because we do have, our life isn't that busy, that we don't have any time at all. But what we do carry is a lot of busyness in our minds of what we like, what we dislike, what we would like to avoid, what we're worried about. So just paying attention to that, and even this monastery itself, Chittaviveka, the name came from Lumpa Sumedho realizing he was not going to get a whole lot of physical solitude anymore, and he needed to find the solitude within himself, whatever he was doing. And, I think he's been an exemplar in that. He's always taken time to be, have quiet time and whatnot, but also you really have to learn how to step back from your own mind and to give attention to that sense of solid connection with the Dhamma practice, and as opposed to it being an ideal that you're chasing. It's something that you're living and trying to make real, rather than it being an idea that's formulated in your mind out there that is somehow more pristine, more pure than you can, you can realistically experience. Because so much of the feeling of dissatisfaction is not getting what one wants. And to be able to just be present with the mind, or present with the mind that's wanting. How can I be comfortable with that mind that's wanting? Is a really important avenue of investigation. Paying attention to it. I've found one of the things that's so important is that investigation of bhava tanha and vibhava tanha, because it's that's where we lose our it's not so much the craving for sensuality or sensual gratification or stimulation. I mean, it's there just from having a human form, but that sense of being and non-being, that sense of trying to prop up an identity or prop up a sense of who and what I am, or what I don't want to be, or how things should be, how things shouldn't be. And that we can really learn incredibly valuable lessons by investigating that more closely. And that happens all the time. It doesn't happen just when we're sitting by ourselves in the forest on a 1-month-long retreat. But I think in general, the Sangha of our communities, and we try to pay attention to having a daily routine that's supportive, but it's also you've got some time to be on your own. And then using the opportunity for service to the community because if we don't really develop a sense of giving and sharing and loving kindness and a sense of compassion, any amount of meditation that you do never really comes to much fruition. It's still an intellectual concept that we miss the mark on. So that cultivating a heart connection with the fact that here we are in this human condition, not very happy. And how do we help each other? How do we be of service to each other? And especially when you live in a community that, is focused on spiritual practice, and we have a great opportunity.
Yeah,
People often say, when I was in Amarati, they would say, like, Amarati is more like an institution.
Yeah.
What's the difference? What the perspective they... How do they look at it? Yeah.
Well, I mean, you look at it through suspicion and negativity. I mean, it does have... I mean, sometimes... I mean, fortunately, I'm at Amaravati, but one of the conditions that I set was no business meetings. So I'm kind of... I'm in a unique position. So, I mean, it's a... I mean, part of it is the size of it. Once you get to a certain size, then you actually have to institute structures that help things to function. Otherwise, it just descends into kind of chaos or anarchy, or it's not helpful, or people get fall by the wayside, really. So it does need structure. And so that's what an institution is something that has a lot of structure. And to a certain degree, out of necessity, of the sheer numbers of people, I mean, at this Vasa is 25 monks, 2 novices, 2 Anagarikas. This must be about a dozen Siladhara and 3 or 4 Anagarikas. Plus you got 10 long-term lay, men, lay women. Plus you've got the short-term lay visitors. So, you know, it's a big group. It's about 60 people, I would think, on a regular basis living in the monastery. And I mean, there's always benefits and drawbacks to anything. So that, I mean, the drawbacks are is that once you've got that many people, it gets a bit more complex necessarily. And the benefit is that, gosh, I mean, the blessings that it brings to so many people is really, and plus it is still preserving a high standard of training for monastics and the opportunity for lay people to plug in and gain the access to teachings. It's like the, because there's, I mean, how long has the Saturday meditation workshops been going on?
My understanding, I mean, Ajahn Kruko, you might know, but probably right back to near the beginning is what I've heard.
Yeah, well, I've been a Amarati monk for many years.
It's
been going on a long time. So that they're so, you know, close to 40 years, and just the fact that people know that they can, and a lot of people. Somebody was saying there's probably more people come to that Saturday workshop than they do to the lunar observance talks, especially on like even Lumpa Sumedho's, which is on the lunar observance days. And so it's a, it's amazing. And then during the Vasa, every Sunday, there's a Dhamma talk given with the themes people can. So people have, and that's beside the regular schedule of things. So it's an incredible gift to the world. So a tremendous benefit. But, you know, it does come with a certain complication of people. And it's like, I mean, certainly in Christian monasticism, St. Benedict, who started the first monastic order, set up the first kind of, say, Christian vinaya, his ideal size of community was the number of monks that you could get around a fireplace and keep warm. You know, so you're not more than 15 kind of max. So, you know, so it's, and of course, I mean, there's huge Benedictine monasteries around the world now, but in terms of, you know, monasticism, so that it becomes, necessarily, I think it's, if you do it with a lot of attention and see a place like Amaravati is still drawing people who want to come and train, because there's training still being given, training accessible. You know, and I think it's also balanced by having smaller monasteries that people can come to jitters. And know, you've got, it's a lot quieter, it's a lot, so you a different pace of life, different amount of contact, so that it's helpful for as a balance. But it's also alternating in the same way that, say, like at, when I was the abbot of Wat Nanachan, Wat Nanachan's always been a large, fairly busy monastery. But, I mean, I set up a couple really secluded monasteries for retreat. There are Bujamkong and Taodam. And then plus we had all of the branch monasteries of Wakrapong that we could send monks to and just alternate back and forth. I think it's helpful to have you've got both those options and to be careful about things, because sometimes the institutions of like a religion, I mean, it's kind of like what comes to mind is Ajahn Siripanyo's reply to his, or response to his father when, this is when he was just, he'd been an Anagarika or Pakao, he'd been a novice, he was determined he was going to take his bhikkhu ordination. His father, very upset, and he's kind of a wealthy businessman, very successful. And he's like, I can't believe a son of mine is going to commit himself to an organized religion. And Ajahn Siripanyo was, oh, Dad, you don't have to worry. Buddhism in Thailand is not organized. So to a certain degree, there is this, there's a fluidity there that needs to be kept. So if things get too rigid, then it gets problematic. And that's a tendency in religion and even in Buddhism, where you're just fearful about change, fearful about making sure all the rules are kept absolutely, and you forget that it's actually for freeing your heart. So the institution can take over as opposed to the spirit of it. So it's important to reflect on it. Yes.
Do you have any, like, if you have to choose like one spot or one monastery maybe in Thailand that you can always go back to, you had like the best moments or experience while in Thailand? Do you have one in mind on the top of your head?
Taodam. I mean, I got a real special place in my heart for Taodam. I mean, it's. Have you been?
I've been there.
Yes, yeah. You know what I mean.
Little personal cootie there too, don't they? On top of the hill.
Right, the very top. Very top. When I used to be able to get up there. The last time I was there, there was a kuti down below by the kitchen, and I'm relegated to that. But even that is really, it's still very quiet, and it's just, there's the nature is, I love the wild, it is a place that is really, of course, it holds many memories for me, and I have an affinity for that area. I was drawn there, but I've also it's been conducive to for me. I've done several retreats there. It was also at Taodam that I was on an extended period of retreat. It would probably be, that'd be 1994, and that. Which is when it was before I came to Chitters. I did a year's retreat in Chitters Forest. I did a period of retreat at Taodam and getting things stabilized to receive Sangha in the future. And but it was then that was it was just very peaceful, very still, very clear. And then I had this intuition, insight, vision that was the end of my time in Thailand. That I would be leaving Thailand. And I remember the first sort of feeling was, no! That was really, that was a very strong, again, I feel very comfortable in Thailand. But I also was sort of to a certain degree, recognizing that there was some, you know, I was wanting to do something where I could really maybe give a lot more solid monastic training for people, and having a place in the West would give me the opportunity a bit more. Because also, as I'd lived in Thailand for over 20 years by then, and so, you know, I'm not that old, and I'm this well-known already. I've got this many responsibilities expected of me. This is not going to get better. So I need to figure out an option. So that's where I ended up. I didn't know where I was going to end up, and that was that kind of insight. Then I had an insight. I was walking down, you know, from where you are. In the old days, with the trail to the sala, the outside sala, that wasn't there yet. It was actually done when I was, during that period of time, was in retreat. Because I organized the sala and the three kutis to be built. But you used to come down the face of that hill, which was very steep. And so walking down there, and I had kind of image vision in my mind come through. It wasn't what I was seeing. It was something else. And I'm going to be. And then, so then it was. And I didn't know what to make of it. I don't really, not all that into it. And just sort of let it sit for a long time. And then sort of thinking it did wrong. Then it seemed, after being in retreat here for some time, and as Ajahn Karunipo came back first, you spent the winter in California.
You did. Oh, yes,
yes. You were in Nevada.
Some time ago.
Yeah, Ajahn Amaro was there. So then Ajahn Amaro came back a little bit after that.
Yes.
And then after hearing from you, and I've met many of the people involved in, they were sort of part of the Sangapala. Really good people, because I grew up in Canada, so I was very suspicious of Americans. not that comfortable. But then there's all these good people just kept showing up. And then Ajahn Amaro came back and said, you know, there's a lot of, you know, sincere interest the Sangha wasn't really keen to give their approval, because they felt it needed more monastic involvement, more like actually have a Sangha there just beginning, because America is such a big thing to deal with. And so then I asked Ajahn Amaro if he was interested in having me help out. So that began another chapter. But it was, and then when I did get to Abayagiri, and walking the land, got to the place where the ordination platform is now, that area there, and it looks out across the end. So, well, that's what I saw in Dada. So I was saying, okay, I'm in the right place.
We knew that.
Yeah, and Ajahn Kundama was one of the people who sort of these Americans who kept showing up. Because it was 1989, you did a... The first time I went back to Canada, I was away from Canada for 16 years before I went home for my first visit. And when I went there to visit family, I flew Thai International, and in those days they flew into Seattle. And then there was a group that was associated with this Theravada Buddhism forest tradition, interested to help out in some way or be involved in some way. So they set up some talks for me to give and a weekend retreat. Jim Krundamo, young Tom Mario is there.
We still have, I don't know, I think it's, as you said, in the top kuti, we have your chair still in there.
Oh, wow.
Don't pass this chair.
That's very sweet.
Well, I've been listening to your answers with interest. It sounds like you're quite a community builder. in various places.
Yes, that has happened.
when I first came here, one of the things I was struck by, it's only a year ago, was the way that the community works. It's just so, even for someone as chaotic as myself, it works amazingly well.
Yeah.
And I wondered, in terms of, it made me think, oh, a lay community based on monastic principles, that would be interesting. I don't know if I would ever want to try and build one, but even joining one. Have you seen any examples of lay communities, not like the Sangha dispersed around an area, which is quite common in the West, I guess, but whether anyone's built like a community where we could all be together based on monastic principles, or do you have any advice around that?
Not really. But, you know, I'd have to call them, but not really, because, you know, what it really takes is a commitment to, like, a standard of precepts or training. And so, like, having a vinaya, having a discipline that's sort of not dependent on the individuals. And that's what, so the say, as monastics, then we have the vinaya, and that, you know, despite you having very different personalities, very different characters living together, you've got that thread that helps to sort of unify, and something that you have to give yourself to. And for I haven't seen a lay community that has, maybe they haven't attempted to set up a really clear guidelines. I mean, I see some of the lay communities that are maybe close to the monasteries and who are influenced by the monastic form. And I think of Portland Friends of Dhamma. It's a lay group that's associated with Abayagiri, but it's in Portland, Oregon. And they've done a really good job of modeling on the monastic form and taking the example and bringing in monastic teachers, but it's a lay organization that is run by and also the lay taught by the lay people. So that's something. And then
not a residential community.
But it's not a residential community. That's a different thing. Living together, that's another thing. And so that's I haven't seen that. And I think there's similarly, because I haven't. This is the first time I've actually lived at Amaravati, resided at Amaravati. I've come many, many times as a visitor over the years. But I see the Amaravati Lay Buddhist Association, they seem to be quite a strong group of people who support each other and have a commitment to encouraging each other and finding ways to encourage each other, which is very inspiring. So that's something. I don't know, have you, here in Britain, has there been anything?
Well, I wonder whether it's, I've never been to Gaia House, but there is a residential, a resident community there,
right,
that is working there to support it. And they have, but here again, I've not been there, but they actually live there full time,
right,
a number of them. And people take on different various roles, and so I gather they have guidelines, and so I don't know whether that would count, or even like the Sunyata in the west of Ireland, oftentimes there's a group of people living there. Of course, now it's being aimed more at being a monastery, but and so then, around those values, but I've not lived there. So,
yeah, that's why I asked, because in my background, like Gaia House has been around for quite some time, but I don't know very much about it. I've never been out there, but they're a lay community that's committed to Dhamma practice, as opposed to being just a retreat center, which is there are, you know, certainly in different places, there's, whether here or in America, there's like retreat centers, but, you know, people don't actually live together as a community, so they're functioning in that way.
I've seen it in other lineages. I think Sami Ling, something like that, in Scotland. And there's a place in Brighton where they have one day residents.
Uh-huh, right.
I'm just curious, because you've also been in Thailand as well.
Right.
They've got a different, the relationship between the community and the monasteries.
Yeah, and in Thailand, you've got every permutation, really, because it's, you know, it's quite rich, really, in terms of, yes, there is all sorts of monasteries, but then within that, then you've got different lay communities or the Meche communities or monks, nuns living in different places in different ways, you know, and there's some really exceptional communities. I mean, there's a lot of not so inspiring examples as well. That's just, again, it's an old religion, so it's, or old institutions, and they get they start to wear at the edges after a while. But it certainly, there's great examples there. You know, I think of, I mean, it's not, the community is still existing. I haven't heard much about it, but the, like Upasika Ki Nyana Yon, she said, teachings of hers translated into English, and there, those are, and she's, it was an incredible, she was a lay woman who had nuns and lay women living with her. And a very strong community, and her, I mean, her teachings, she was tough. So, even listening to her in Thai, I mean, she was very formidable. Koi Phang Mai? Yeah.
She sounds like a man.
Yeah. She's quite a deep voice, yeah.
Like a man.
Yeah, and but boy, was she direct, which is quite exceptional for anybody in Thailand.
Ajahn Minister Ajahn Jeff doing translations of her work, so that says something.
That says something, yeah. He made it.
Yeah.
And then the community is still there. I know that the passed on, she passed away quite some time ago, and then it passed on to elders who are there. I know the community is still there, and how vibrant it is, I don't know. But yeah, there's great examples of, and I know of, I went to visit a community of who was lay men, lay women, living together in Thailand, and they had a commitment to keeping a sila, you know, just having that sense of, you know, so you have to make that commitment. That's something that's a bit harder to accomplish in the West. It's that set, because, you know, culturally, you know, we're not very good at liking rules. And so and everybody wants to do it, especially in America, is your sort of the new and proper way. But it's all, you know, it's usually based on somebody's opinion or their feeling at the time. So like for as a monastic form, having the Vinaya, which is, I mean, it's just bottom line, this is the way it is. If you don't like it, it's a voluntary thing, but it has a unifying and harmonizing thread, especially when it's held with wisdom. I mean, rules, just for the keeping rules, is not a, it's not a great standard for community harmony or well-being. But having standards that you give yourself to and that uplift you and up your game is really important.
How do you find it best to differentiate between true insights and insight farmers?
True insights will always be peaceful, which is not necessarily a... You have to be willing to, because sometimes you can be incredibly peaceful and have an insight and then still be deluding yourself. So you have to be willing to watch. But, you know, a true insight is really peaceful. I mean, it might stir you up, but there's a sense of solidity or a sense of truth. And so that the mind is willing to go still. And it's always accompanied by a sense of relinquishment and letting go. You know, a really true insight, you don't get anything from. You know, in this, what happens is you're, wow, I can let that go finally. And that's the relief.
you say that afterwards the mind, the conditioned mind can make him but that's a different story.
That's a different story. Yeah.
To learn to keep that apart.
Yeah, I think that sense, I mean, it's really helpful to realize that, what we're really looking for is something that simplifies. It really does. It makes our hearts less complicated, less complex, less stuff. And that's an incredible relief.
And Paul, as I increasingly find myself in situations of either... You know, sharing, you know, either leading a retreat or doing Q&As and maybe also giving guidance on meditation, and just, you know, repeatedly that the questions coming up about samadhi, concentration, jhana, things like that, and people, and our tendency to measure, that measuring, and just how much discontent. And one of the things I reflect on and the way at least I try and answer is often saying, well, how often do we actually know? Like, we're constantly measuring, and when do we know enough is enough to be able to develop insight and things? And it's that constant feeling that I get from people, they're expressing their discontent and lack of, that it's never enough.
Yeah, and it never is.
I'm just wondering if you could offer some, any reflections around that.
Well, I mean, it's the nature of desire and the nature of the measuring mind. It's just you never get enough, even if it's samadhi and insight. It's never going to be enough, so long as it's being measured. So that the samadhi or insight, again, is accompanied by this, the relief of relinquishment and letting go. And I remember Ajahn Sumedho asking Ajahn Chah a similar sort of question, in the sense of, you know, wanting to know, what is samadhi? You know, so I know what I'm doing, and I know I'm doing it right. And Ajahn Chah's response, oh, samadhi is a holiday for the heart. So that, you know, we turn it into a chore and an accomplishment. And as long as it's a chore and or an accomplishment that we're chasing after, it can't really be peaceful. And it doesn't mean you don't do it, but it's sort of, how do I hold it so I'm not so goal-oriented? I think it's important to be just process-oriented, interested in the process of being attentive, or interested in the process of being settled. Because that samadhi is, you know, some of the definitions, it's not that the definitions are wrong, but I think they're misleading sometimes. You know, when you say, you know, samadhi as it's concentration. Samadhi is concentration. And just the word concentration, all you say, you concentrate the mind, and you're already tense. And it's just to be, get out, right out of the gate. And also that sense of the literal meaning of the word concentrate is to make small. Like you concentrate a liquid, you reduce it down, you decrease it, and you make it smaller by concentrating. And the mind of samadhi is not a small mind, it's a big mind, it's spacious. It's light, it's clear. So that being, and also the sense of, one of the images that Ajahn Chah used, I mean, a couple of images that Ajahn Chah used, which I think are really helpful for thinking about samadhi. It's kind of like samadhi is the container that holds the mind with awareness and is able to see clearly what's there without being shaken by it. So that the image that he gives is in rural Thailand, you've got these kind of little like bamboo woven domes that are maybe like this big, you know, around. And you put a couple of chickens or a few chickens in there, you put that over it, And the chickens will sort of move around and you throw some rice to them and then they stay there and you don't have to think about them. You know, the same thing with like samadhi is the kind of dome that you put over the mind, that you observe it and watch it and not fight with it, not struggle with it, not try to drive a stake in the ground and put a tether on the chicken so it's fighting against it. It's the same with you. You've got to give your mind enough space to not feel cramped, but enough mindfulness that it's not wandering. And so that it's a balance of mind that you're developing so that it's able to, you know, be settled, and then the clarity comes from that. Because even the, so it's like it's in the Majjhima 44 questions from Visakha to Bhikkhuni Dhammadina, where, you know, what is the basis of samadhi? I mean, what is samadhi? Samadhi is one-pointedness of our unification of mind. Is a better trend. So the mind actually unifies. It's not at odds with itself. It's not struggling. It's clear. But it's unified. And even when one of the images that Ajahn Chah gives for unification, it's like having a bowl of fruit. You've got apples, you've got pears, you've got strawberries. I mean, yeah, but it's in a bowl and you can see what's there, but it's not sort of scattered. It's not falling all over the place. It's unified. To that, and that's the amount of unification that you need. It doesn't have to be squished down into a little point. So that the unification of the mind, say, with the basis is the four foundations of mindfulness, the equipment of the four right efforts. That is samadhi. And so it's got many components, and it is a balancing. And that's something that Ajahn Chah, Thai forest tradition, you put a lot of emphasis on the sense of balancing. Because it's as soon as you sort of, it's got to be this, it can't be that, you're in a conundrum already. Whereas if it's this quality of what Ajahn Chah used to call just right, puddhi, it's, you know, that sense of, oh, it's just right, it's balanced. And it's just kind of nice. Bo sum, bo dam, bo dam, bo kao, bo yao, bo sam, puddhi, puddhi. it's good for the ties. It's not high or low. It's not high or low. It's not black or white. It's not long or short. It's just right. And you know, that's an elusive quality that you have to be willing to intuit, rather than to, as soon as you try to fix it, oh, I've got it, you're going to be in for disappointment or frustration. So it's the sense of being comfortable with, where's that balance? How do I hold that balance? How do I hold it skillfully? Because it does take, the mind does unify. It's not just sort of scattered all over the place. It does have an object, but it can be, you know, any of the four foundations of mindfulness are fair game, which is just about anything. And then the need to establish a quality of effort that attends to the quality of mind. Because it is interesting when you say, talk about the four right efforts, it's not about how spectacular you look on your walking meditation path or how long you sit. It's about the quality of mind. Does the wholesome qualities increase and unwholesome qualities decrease? And you put the effort toward the increasing of the skillful, the decreasing of the unskillful, and there's your right effort. Yes?
Is that possible to do in a 24-hour period? Because I find it difficult to continuously do what you said.
Yes, it is.
Especially when I'm asleep.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, a cumulative practice that you gain skill with. And also it goes, it's not like you start your practice and it's just onward and upward, getting better and better all the time. You've got to be ready for ups and downs and successes and failures, and just being patient with that. but recognizing that as you, the more, sort of gaining an appreciation of the fact that when I am clear, when I am steady, actually my life goes a lot better. So just keeping it that simple, rather than sort of, you know, what did I attain? Did I get the jhanas? How close was I to the jhanas? Did I miss the jhanas? Which one did I miss? it goes around and around. So just sort of recognizing that, you know, what is it that helps us to be, you know, a bit more clear, a bit more steady, a bit more peaceful, and working at that. And as we work at that, you find the path really opening up for you.
I remember at Nanachat Lampur, once you visited Nanachat.
Yes.
And you had a meeting with monastics, and someone asked a question like, Lampur, what advice would you have for like young monastics on the path?
Yes. What did I say?
Watch the video. The peaks and valleys.
Okay.
Ups and downs.
Okay, yeah.
Really nice. Quite simple.
Oh, good. Yeah, because it's, you know, in an ideal world, we would just get more peaceful, more wise. The reality isn't like that. You have to be willing to sort of, to be steady within, you know, even the peaks are, you know, it's okay. Yeah. Peaks are, it's a peak. And that was good. Okay. Let's not get too, you know, sort of puffed up with that. Or expectation getting too out of control. And then the sense of, oh yeah, the difficulties come and the drudgery of living a life of practicing Dhamma, sometimes it can get dreary. So how do I keep working with that?
Do you think the annoying of the peace of samadhi is always something which will be remembered, not as to see it again?
Yeah.
It's there.
Well, I think one of the things is...
Faith. It gives a kind of confidence.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that is so important, that your confidence and motivation is actually based on a sense of, yeah, this definitely has results. This is really good. This is worth it. How do I keep going at this? Because it's... you know, when the mind does settle and the mind becomes very peaceful and the mind becomes very clear, yeah, there really isn't much in the world that looks that interesting after that.
May I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
So, yeah, insights give a lot of confidence in the practice, a lot of faith, a lot of trust.
Yeah.
So when it offers that kind of clarity of mind, that confidence is there. So when insights come, is it just ephemeral and not like nourishing? Is there a time to just nourish those insights that are there that has built so much confidence in the practice?
Yes, I mean, it is important. Yes, I mean, I think it is important to nourish them. It's also important not to get obsessed with them. And, you know, so again, it's that... is this sense of balance that's so important to be attending to in that, because you can really encourage yourself and support yourself by recollecting and reflecting on insights that one has had. And it's sort of like, yeah, I can do this. Sometimes it's really, you know, you're really supporting yourself in that way. And then there's also the extreme of where, you know, one is holding out a carrot that one is never going to get again, sort of thing. So it's a double-edged sword. But we do have to learn, you know, to be successful in meditation, you do have to learn how to encourage yourself. And that's part of, you know, think of the four bases of spiritual success, iddhipadas, chanda, virya, jitta, vimamsa. Chanda, of course, is motivation. It's literally desire. The Buddha's encouraging you to get desire going, get motivation going. Effort, of course. Jitta, the mind has to be sort of settled on something. And vimamsa is, you know, translated in different ways, you know, investigation. But in the actual word itself, it's like a reviewing. So that reviewing of one's experience that helps to support chanda, that motivation, that desire, that wish to experience dhamma, experience truth, experience the wholesome and the skillful, experience bright states of mind. That's an important thing that needs to be nourished. But it's, you know, you have to be careful, because sometimes the, you know, we do it to ourselves, you know, because then chanda sort of slips into tanha, and then the sense of identity and identification of me gaining or me losing. I had those insights and they're gone. I'm just such a hopeless meditator. So you really have to pay attention to the content, so that you really are supporting and encouraging yourself. But it's a really important skill, because it's that is the, you know, because sometimes we wait for insights and inspiration to somehow come along. I can still remember this. It was a cartoon in the New Yorker. This is before I became a monk. It's still in my memory. And it's of two, you know, two kind of looks like two derelicts, homeless, winos, sitting on a park bench, kind of quite disheveled and empty bottle between them. Another one, on the bench beside themselves, and they're sitting there. And then the caption is, "Let's face it, Sid, not having been born great, nor having achieved greatness, one can only assume we'll have it thrust upon us." It really doesn't work that way. You have to put the causes in, so that sense of encouraging oneself is really important. But, you know, it comes with the rider on it. Is what's the effect when one does that? Is what kind of are we demanding or expecting too much of ourselves?
Or your favorite Calvin and Hobbes one, the TV bouncing.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah, what the heck was that? That's another
I'm not sure if I can remember either. Waiting for Hobbes is asking Calvin, you know, like, what
you right. I mean, I've got it written down here. It's worthy of sharing. It's worthy of sharing. But Calvin and Hobbes, there's always something really good. Yeah, here it is. So Calvin's just slumped in an easy chair, watching TV. Hobbes asks, "What you doing?" Calvin says, "I'm killing time while I wait for life to shower me with meaning and happiness." Okay, with that, maybe we can wrap it up and get ready for preaching.